Reach it overcome. Reach it overcome. Someday. Darling, here in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome someday.
Welcome to another episode of the Irish People Podcast. In this episode, we discuss the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association, its formation, the introduction of internment, and the events of Bloody Sunday. We are delighted to be joined by Kevin McCorry. Kevin is originally from Belfast and was organiser of the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association from 1969 until 1975. He was Chief Steward and on the lorry that fronted the Civil Rights March in Derry on Bloody Sunday on the 30th of January 1972, when the peaceful marchers were attacked by British paratroopers, leading to the deaths of 14 unarmed civilians. Kevin has championed progressive causes in both parts of Ireland all his adult life, and he is currently director of the annual Desmond Greaves Weekend Summer School in Dublin. You're very welcome. Can we talk first of all about the formation of NICRA, your involvement, and the need for a coordinated campaign for civil rights in the North, as well as the importance of a Bill of Rights?
The thing about civil rights is it has been written out of history. You know, the thing, there is no serious academic work that looks at the history of the civil rights movement. Yet the civil rights movement created, I mean, the Good Friday Agreement isn't anything really beyond what civil rights had pushed for and had in fact achieved by, even under O'Neill, there was a reform program. Yet what is projected is that, in fact, first of all, that civil rights was, it was driven off the streets and effectively, you know, the whole scenario in 1970, it was driven off the streets. Yet there was a whole political program which could have been driven forward in that period, and that's not even examined by any serious historian or whatever. You know, that's my big gripe about it. And, you know, if you look for what is the origin of the civil rights movement, well, essentially, there were two elements that came to make up the civil rights movement. Within the Irish context, there was a British element to the civil rights struggle, which was important as well. But if you look at the Irish dimension to civil rights, it was essentially there were two elements. There were the politicizing forces within the Republican movement around Cathal Golding and your father and so on, who after the 56-62 campaign saw that there was that was not the way forward, mm-hmm. and set about politicizing the Republican movement. In other words, trying to work out a revolutionary politics to achieve the objectives of the Republican movement, which was an all-Ireland independent republic. And the second element to it was the elements within the trade union, the Northern trade union movement, who were also saw that the discrimination and repression in terms of the Special Powers Act and so on, was preventing the development of a progressive labour working class politics. And they came together. There was in from the 60, 63, 64, but particularly in 65, there was a conference held at which the idea of a civil rights movement was pushed for. Now, this was before, officially, the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association was set up in 1967. But there was actually in 65, there was a meeting held at which Republicans, trade unionists, labor people, and so on met, and it was, and they discussed the setting up of a civil rights movement. Now, the importance of that was that that was pre Paisley having us, you know, after that you had 66 and you had the commemorations from 1916. And Paisley was able to use that, and there was an increase in sectarianism. My contention would be, number one, that if the civil rights movement had got off the ground in 65, it would have been able to push a lot of that sectarianism to the side, and it would have had a much more significant Protestant working class input into it, which would have given it a totally different profile. But what happened at that particular time was that the Labour Party, Northern Ireland Labour Party, which was an offshoot of the British Labour Party in Northern Ireland, it didn't want to push on, well, it didn't want to push on discrimination, because that would have been, you know, it wouldn't have fitted in with its sort of vision of Northern Ireland. And it certainly didn't want to push on the Special Powers Act. So it went off and it said, we have to go back to our committee and so on. And they never really come back. And that meeting, which was very, very important, it ended up without an organization getting off the ground. Now, the second dimension to it, there's the Irish dimension, which was essentially politicizing Republicans and Protestant trade unionists, progressive Protestant trade unionists, people like Andy Barr in the shipyards and so on, those people. The second element to it was the campaigning that was going on in Britain. Now, the best illustration of the importance of that was in 1949, the British Labour government passed the Ireland Act. And the Ireland Act had a provision which stated that the constitutional position of Northern Ireland would not change without the without the agreement of the Parliament at Stormont. So that effectively was a unionist veto on any constitutional progress or any constitutional change for Northern Ireland. So that was in 1949, and that was a Labour government that passed that Ireland Act. By 1969, after the civil rights movement and after the campaigns and the marches and so on, I saw there was a lovely plaque that was unveiled of the Coal Island, just before the Coal Island March, the people lining up there, Betty Sinclair, Rebecca McGlade, all those people. After that, by 69, and as a consequence of their campaigning and the marches and so on, the majority of Labour MPs in the British House of Commons were prepared to condemn the absence of civil rights in the North. Now, that didn't happen by accident. That took 15, nearly 20 years of campaigning, of the campaign in the north, but also the campaigns, Connolly Association, groups like that in Britain, to educate the labor movement in Britain on what the situation was in the north. So the from that period, from 49 to 69, there was a total transformation. So then you had the setting up of NICRA in 65, and you had a meeting at which the basis was laid around a program of anti-discrimination for the elimination of discrimination that was in terms of the employment and in housing, for an end to the Special Powers Act. And the Special Powers Act was one of the most pernicious and oppressive pieces of emergency legislation in any part of the world. In fact, Verwoerd, the Prime Minister of South Africa, apartheid South Africa, said that he would do away with all his emergency legislation if he could just have the Special Powers Act in South Africa. That was how draconian and repressive it was. So that was obviously an element, and had to be an element in the civil rights program. And then you had gerrymandering, you had the whole thing of one man, one person, one vote, and how the whole system was done, the thing. So that was the basic program. Then you had activities. 67, you had the Coal Island to Dungannon March. Then you had the 5th of October in Derry, and as luck would have it there, you had Gerry Fitt had just been elected in 1966. So he was there. But you also had three Labour MPs were with him that day. So when he was attacked by the police and had, was blood all over his shirt, and quite obviously had been a victim of police repression and violence, they were there, and they were able to go back to the British House of Commons and report on what was going on. Furthermore, you had RTE in one of its very rare excursions north at the time. As luck would have it, that was all filmed. So that absolutely exposed what was going on. And very quickly, the O'Neill introduced a whole set of reforms. Now, they weren't very advanced. For example, they didn't get rid of the Special Powers Act. They didn't promise the abolition of the B specials. They didn't promise the reform of the RUC, but there were reforms there in terms of discrimination in public employment, not in private employment. And also, there were promises in relation to discrimination in the allocation of public housing. So those were reforms there that could have been pushed forward. But the problem always was that there was an element, a politically immature element in the sort of the people's democracy and so on, that so we're saying, on the one hand, damn your reforms, we want socialism immediately, and then acted accordingly. And there was this coat trailing exercise that was the Burntollet March, which simply confirmed what everybody knew. There was sectarianism in the North, and was decided upon as something to do, as part of the thing, it against what the Civil Rights Association had said was, O'Neill has offered these reforms. Okay, deliver them. And in the meantime, we'll not hold marches until we see that we'll have no alternative. That, in other words, you're not genuine or thing. But you had the Burntollet March, and then you had the worse than that. The shortly after that, you had a demonstration in Newry, at which was totally unstewarded. This was in 69, the beginning of 69, and they started to riot. The civil rights supporters, there was a riot. And you have pictures of the police just standing back and laughing, because they saw the effect that that was having on the image of civil rights and the whole thing. And you had splits in NICRA, again on a basis of what I would describe as an ultra-leftist adventurist sort of approach to things. You had a proposal that they were going to hold a march from Belfast city centre up to Stormont, a civil rights march, right through East Belfast. That was proposed by the People's Democracy elements on the NICRA executive. You had Bernadette Devlin, who had just been elected onto the civil rights, into the British House of Commons, she wasn't elected onto the NICRA executive, into the British House of Commons, announced this march in County Derry before the whole thing had been even discussed on the NICRA executive. So you had these adventurous elements on the thing. And then by 1970, you had a situation where you had the breakdown of the thing, and you had the emergence of the provisionals. Now, the provisionals, there's an expression about their origin myth, sort of, a body's origin myth. You know, they create this myth about the thing. And of course, the myth is civil rights was driven off the streets, having won nothing. You know, it was just a victim, and it required a military response. Now, that was expressed by some of the provisional, proto-provisionals, if you like. They used to say about civil rights, damn your concessions, England. We want our country. You know, so in other words, the idea of reform was totally outside their vocabulary. But the point about it is they were either going to try and push those reforms forward, or they were going to just abandon politics altogether, which is of course what happened right in through 1970. The nuances of that whole thing have never really been seriously examined by anyone, because it doesn't fit in with the narrative, the common narrative. Now, for example, you mentioned the Bill of Rights. In 1968, Desmond Graves of the Connolly Association wrote to Harold Wilson, who was the then Prime Minister, calling for a Bill of Rights. That was 1968. NICRA as an organization was calling for a Bill of Rights from 1969-1970 onwards. In 1971, a Bill of Rights for Northern Ireland became the official programme of the British Trade Union Congress. That meant that it was the TUC and the labour movement's policy from 1971 onwards. Now that game was completely abandoned. I mean, that went out the window as the violence sort of escalated, because it was much more difficult to push for that in Britain, as the violence was gone. But that would have been part of a political approach. I mean, it took 15 odd years, 20 years from 1949 up to 1969, from the Government of Ireland Act mentality in the British Labour Party to the majority of British Labour Party MPs condemning the denial of civil rights and so on. But that was politics. Politics just doesn't happen overnight. And the point about it is, as always, the decision was, if go down a violent road, you were always going to have to take in the fact that you were going to increase the whole sectarianism within the North and make any sort of politics impossible. And you go back to the trade unionists, the Protestant trade unionists, who were instrumental in setting up the civil rights, as I say, alongside the politicizing Republicans, the Cathal Goldings and so on, on the thing. Their work was much more difficult. I mean, they were becoming increasingly exposed and being identified with civil rights, and their input into it became less and less. There would have been very, very brave and so on working in the shipyards and so on in an increasingly sectarian context. Although a lot of them did. I mean, were to their eternal credit. But getting the ordinary rank and file and building a politics in which Protestant trade unionists could be involved was more and more difficult. So that would be my sort of a thing. Now, you had then 19, I always think 1970, 71 are pivotal years in the history of the recent history. First of all, the British government could have, and this is always to be remembered, they must always bear the responsibility. They could always have introduced civil rights reforms. The idea of a Bill of Rights is a very progressive demand, but it's a very politically astute demand, because what you were saying to the British government, what the civil rights movement was saying to the British government was, under the Constitution of Northern Ireland, the final say about everything rests with the government in London. There was an article of the Government of Ireland Act, which was the constitution, in inverted commas, of Northern Ireland, that notwithstanding everything else in the Act, the supreme authority for the governing of Northern Ireland rested with the government in London. So what civil rights people who push for a Bill of Rights were saying was, okay, if that's the case, you can introduce legislation over the heads of the government in Stormont that would grant the demands of civil rights in terms of discrimination, in terms of this policing, and remember, policing was a major issue of right through the history of majoritarian Northern Ireland. In other words, when the unionists were the sole governing party in Northern Ireland, in terms of the Special Powers Act, and so on. So, in other words, your Bill of Rights has a number of legs to it. One leg is to redress the grievances that were exposed by and were being pushed for by for redress by the civil rights movement. So that's the first element to it. But the second element to it was that you would remove all constitutional obstacles in the Government of Ireland Act that prevented people working legitimately for a united Ireland. So in other words, and in fact, what you did was you hinted that maybe that is the direction, given consent. That the important thing, that people weren't going to be pushed into a united Ireland. And it wasn't going to, and this was even before all the violence, the 25 years of violence and all, which now makes it, I mean, you know, down so far away, it's impossible almost to envisage. But then it wasn't so, it's such an impossible aspiration. So it was, in fact, it was the Good Friday Agreement. It was a proto form of the Good Friday Agreement. Without some of the things that exist in the Good Friday Agreement, like, for example, the fact that if you're a Catholic, you're in one thing, and if you're a Protestant, you're in another. That was sectarian elements of the Good Friday Agreement. It would have facilitated over time. I'm not saying it would have been in a day or a two. It could have facilitated over time the development of a politics within Northern Ireland, in which constitutional change was not a major obstacle for any sort of rational debate. I mean, the idea of constitutional change, is almost an issue where rational discussion goes out the window and people become, Protestant, I don't never do, sort of that sort of thing. It would have created that a political environment where the option of political and constitutional change over time was not ruled totally out of court as it was. The other thing about it was, is that from the point of view of, the ability of the Unionist Party to use patronage as a way of corralling and disciplining the Protestant population, it would have taken that away from them. Now, that's why it had to come from London. Effectively, that's why the Bill of Rights was a call for a piece of British legislation to do that, because the unionists were not going to cut the ground from under themselves just willy-nilly. But in the context of civil rights, it was a legitimate, and it was also a demand that was, you know, it wasn't far-fetched. It would have been nice. Now, I suppose the debate about the Bill of Rights now, I mean, there's still commissions and all, there's reams and reams of reports on a Bill of Rights, but they're emasculated bills of rights. They're not really bills of they're you know, commissions and all this sort of stuff. There's no blood in them. So the Bill of Rights was a demand to redress grievances and to create a context in which politics was possible, and politics that would include an ability to change the North. Now, that was, of course, what did the British government do when you had, of course, you had that sort of situation after Bloody Sunday, where there was the total world exposure about just what the North was like. And the British government of the time, they introduced direct rule rather than a Bill of Rights. So they took over direct running of the thing. And of course, in the north of Ireland, the Social Democratic and Labour Party welcomed it. It in fact had called for it. The People's Democracy had called for it. And the People's and in fact the newly formed Provisional Sinn Féin called for it as well. Now the point about that was that in fact you had the place then was civil servants, British civil servants, moved into the situation, and there was no politics. There was violence, but there was no politics for all that period. And direct rule was there. And again, there was a failure to see what civil rights was all about.
You talked about the Special Powers Act, and there is no doubt that the introduction of internment was a very serious attack on civil rights by the British and Unionist administrations, an attempt to crush the Republican movement. Nick's response was very assertive. You were organiser at the time.
Well, I was interned.
Right, were you interned that night?
No. I believe they came into the street, but they never came to the house. Wow. I was interned 3 days later. There was a British journalist. There was a member of the Belfast Civil Rights Association and myself, and we were walking up the Falls Road to meet up with Belfast civil rights people to organize a public meeting I think round about Leeson Street. And there was a Captain Campbell of the Green Howards Regiment,
right,
who I had had a number of run-ins with previously. And he jumped out of a jeep and he said, "I'm afraid I have to arrest you." And I was put into the back of the jeep. This was in broad daylight, just at the Falls Baths. And I was put into the back of the jeep and the jeep drove off. And Joe Deegan, who was the civil rights person, shouted at them as we were going, "You'll never beat the Irish," or something to that effect. And I thought, oh, well, they're going fairly well at it at the moment, certainly as far as I'm concerned, but I take your word for it. So anyway, no. So I was brought over. The holding place was on the Antrim Road in Girdwood Barracks. So I was held there for whatever it was, the statutory couple of days, and you're brought in. And it was a pro forma thing as far as I was concerned. They weren't interested in anything about me. There was one occasion where one of the cops pulled out a gun and said, "We could shoot you," which I took him at his word. I said to myself, "Of course you could." And then I was brought over. I had gone to St. Malachy's. And of course, you were brought over from Girdwood to the Crumlin Road via the play area of St. Malachy's. Well, or I think, now I had never been very football inclined when I was in St. Malachy's. So this was all completely new to me, and ended up in the Crumlin Road. And of course, you arrive into the Crumlin Road, you're kept in the basement for the first thing. And then the next morning you were brought into the detainee section thing. And of course, you're brought in and they're all standing on the landings looking over. And of course, the shout went up by the sort of the anti-civil rights elements to the pro-civil rights elements. "Here, there's your man from the Civil Rights Association in to get you out." So that was my introduction to the thing. So it wasn't, but I never graduated. I never graduated to Longcash or any place like that. But what we did see was the treatment that PJ McLean got and Pat Shivers, and so on, and the horrendous, absolutely horrendous. And we set up a civil rights branch in the Crumlin Road, and we had proper meetings and all that sort of stuff, and sent out minutes or to Marquis Street and all this sort of, I mean, it was probably we were certifiable, but at least it was, we felt we were doing something. But the main thing about the civil rights response to internment, which again is lost sight of, and that is the massive rent and rate strike, which was started and had thousands and thousands people involved in it. That's, of course, conveniently forgotten about. And that was people organizing and campaigning and being brave about their living. And they were taking a lot on themselves. And of course, they were being told by the the politicians, and I put that in inverted commas, like the SDLP, the Austin Currys of this world, when they come round looking for your rent, tell them rent spent. The same guy who then became a minister and was enforcing court orders on the people who he was given this absolutely irresponsible advice to, whereas we were saying, well, you know, you have to organize, you have to do, you know, protect yourself.
Yeah.
And then again, that became a thing because there were those who then tried to turn the civil disobedience campaign in. They even actually formulated a description of it, that it was the civil resistance campaign, which was an arm of the bombing and so on. And you had a split. And I remember going to Tyrone at a meeting in Tyrone. And in fact, the entire Tyrone committee had abandoned the civil disobedience thing and turned, wanted to say there were civil resistance. And having a debate and thrashing it out with people, and they then when they saw that it was, you know, that was a disastrous thing to do, reverted then to civil disobedience. There were political issues and tensions and so on. Which was important. And then there were the marches, and but Bloody Sunday wasn't the only march. There was a Falls Park march, and there was there were other marches as well. And of course that brought about, I mean, the authorities then, in terms of the British authorities, they had to decide what way they were going to deal with that. And then there was the whole issue behind, you know, why Bloody Sunday? Why did they do what they did? Which is a whole big dynamic, which again hasn't been properly thing. I mean, as I see it, there was the element of there was actually an internal struggle going on within the so-called security forces. Remember, the Tories had been elected in the previous year, and the Tories were going to push for a much harder line. And then you had the residuals of when Labour was in power, where there was a hard policy, okay, I mean, in terms of beating people up and doing all the things that armies occupying streets do. And there were killings as well. But the changeover was taking place from the tour, from Heath got in, and you had the curfew in the Lower Falls just shortly after that. Total blanket of an area, closed down of an area, people being just confined to their homes and all the rest of it. And again, people showing resistance and so on, and coming from the outlying areas with the prams full of food and all for people. I mean, it was heroism of an exceptional kind on the stuff. But it was ordinary people doing that. It wasn't elitist people who were taking to themselves that they, you know, knew better and were, you know, and all the rest of it. So you had marches, you had civil disobedience and so on, but the security policy was getting harder and harder. And Derry was considered by the Belfast ones as being out of line with that process for a number of accidental reasons. The head of the police was Lagan, Superintendent Frank Lagan, who was the epitome of soft policing. You know, he would talk to NICRA, the local Betty Bridget Bond of civil rights. He'd be on the phone to her every other day. He was talking to community groups. He was doing policing as insofar as he could do it in a situation where he had internment and increasing repression as the official policy throughout Northern Ireland. He was doing what he could do. And again, as luck would have it, the head of the army in the thing was under his influence because he saw that, you know, it was to an extent, it was working. So the combo of the two of them made for a less repressive situation. But this didn't suit Belfast. And Tuzo was the head man, and he was regularly back and forth to London, and he was meeting with the top civil servants and so on. Now, it's getting to that the historians should be doing, because we know that there was that element of that they then came in and the paras were epitomized repression. Remember the year before the Ballymurphy killings and all the rest of it? 9 out of the 10 people killed in Ballymurphy were killed by the paras. Remember Emma Groves, blinded on there on the Andersonstown Road in her house, shot in the face, with a plastic bullet, and all the other incidents. Remember who the second in command of the paras was in Belfast, Brigadier Frank Kitson. And Brigadier Frank Kitson was the guy who was the expert on counterinsurgency. And he had learned his trade in Aden, and he'd learned his trade in colonial enterprises that were taking place. And he was pushing the thing. So the paras, if you like, were Heath's agents on earth. Now, Tuzo was going across, and he was advising the British government what their thinking was. The Tories' natural inclination was harder and harder. Now, it's that link. If you could get documents that would, or if you could show just the whole dynamic of what was going on there, you would get it to the British government. We have it as far as the top brass of the military in Northern Ireland is concerned. Because remember, the head honcho of the thing was, he was actually on the ground at Barrier 14 in the thing. Now, the guy who, the local Derry commander, in terms of military, you know, the power structure of that day, he was the guy who, you know, was given the orders. But the guy at Barrier 14 was superior to him. He had his paras. He had the paras there with him. And everybody in the military knew the paras were there for a purpose. Because, I mean, if the paras were there for a policing operation, why not give them a few batons and put them at why have them there with SLRs, with the rifles, if they weren't going to use them? And from 4 o'clock to 4:30, the paras are actually indirectly putting pressure on the local commander, saying, we're ready to move, we're ready to move. Even when your man refuses to give them the order to go in, they then go on to another regiment or other soldiers, and they say, another unit, and they say, are there still people rioting there? We're saying that, but he's not believing us. Will you tell headquarters? And they then go to headquarters and say to headquarters, they're still rioting. So they're putting pressure on them implicitly by moving forward. They're putting pressure on them explicitly by asking for orders to go in, which means to kill. And they're putting pressure on them indirectly by getting another unit to say they're still rioting, we still need to go in. So much so that commander goes into Lagan and says to Lagan, the paras want to go in. Now, the paras are his, directly under his command. So it doesn't matter a damn what they want. He's the guy who gives the orders. It's not up to them to want to go in or not want to go in. So he's put under such pressure, he does give the order to go in. And he gives an order for them to go in at a particular time. And 3 or 4 minutes later, he, if you like, says, if you haven't done, see, the whole scenario was supposed to be that they go in to arrest. They were to do the arrest operation. So he then gives the order for them to go in, or accedes to what everybody in the military command want. Having done that, he then, a short time after that, about 3 to 4 minutes after that, he says, if you haven't made any arrests, come back and await further orders. But in that period of time, they have started to shoot. And that's all the time they needed. They just needed 10 minutes to do what they did. So it's tracing that. You can see the link to the top brass of the army, but it's the link to the political crowd in London. But of course, they have covered their tracks so well. I mean, they have generations upon generations of been able to cover their tracks. So it's done. But I mean, if there was some, you know, if there was some academic, or there was some who was really serious about doing a research on it, it would do it. And of course, what that did was effectively, it became an argument that there was no way except, you know, respond kind for kind. You had the Newry March the next week, and it was a massive demonstration. But I always think the size of the Newry March has always been exaggerated. People say there were 60, 70,000 at the Newry March. Well, I don't know what it was, different starting points and all. It was very thing. But I always think that the Derry March was actually a bigger march. It was a more popular thing, because what happened was it started off in the Craigan and it marched down, and it, at each street corner, thousands of people joined it. You know, it was, so it built and it built, so that by the time it got down, it was absolutely colossal. There was 30,000 at the very least on it, you know. Of course, Lord Widgery, he said there were only several hundred on it. So he must have been there at a bad time, but on the thing. But of course, the direct rule thing was the political. It gave them the opportunity to introduce direct rule. And that was the most disastrous, absolutely disastrous thing from a civil rights point of view, direct rule. Because as I say, the British civil servants came in onto the situation. And as somebody said, you know, if you wanted a united Ireland, it would have been, it's 1,000 times more difficult to push from a united Ireland to from direct rule to a united Ireland, because there's no political, you know, debate, discussion, development, all you know, working out political, you know, political processes, political demands, and so on. If because it's the British civil servants that are doing all that, you know. Already mentioned the direct rule, which was the most important political development from it, and then from the direct rule, then the British then began to push this idea of partnership government and all that sort of stuff, and the thing. But the I think the main thing was, the appetite wasn't there for civil rights marches and so on. The civil disobedience campaign continued. And the support continued for it. But you see, as a spin-off of the on Bloody Sunday, the British showed just what they would do. British government showed just what they would do. The reaction was that, okay, well, we will answer that with more of with violence. And then that had a further spin-off in that those who were saying that the civil disobedience was not about ending in term. You see, the demands of the whole campaign was that there would be no talks with the British government until internment was ended. That was an important thing. And the British, that was the main thing at that stage was they wanted to talk to the SDLP, because that was, they saw the SDLP as the most malleable political element. So they were determined to do that. So any breach of the no talks thing weakened the campaign against internment. And of course, I'm forgetting now what I can't now for the life of me remember what the chronology was, but there was a breach of that. I don't know, did they, were there talks? No, there weren't, there wouldn't have been talks. All I know is that that solidarity began to weaken. NICRA didn't have a big stick in that. NICRA couldn't call a massive big demonstration because that wasn't a viable proposition in the circumstances. So NICRA then was gradually moving back into the, from the center stage back in the thing. And it was either the violence for the provisionals or the politics of the SDLP. And for neither of them was there any real sort of conception of what civil rights was about and what a democratic campaign was about. And that was the thing. And I remember there was a meeting in Casement Park, a committee meeting of NICRA. And there was a lot, you know, we were really very uncertain about how to go forward. And I think that, you know, and that was, in many ways, when I think back on it, we were almost been, although Madge Davison and all the carried on NICRA for a considerable period after that, but effectively it was never such an important force as it could have been then. Derry civil rights continued on, and Tyrone civil rights continued on, but it was, you know, it became, you know, you were talking about local issues, which were important. I'm not denigrating them or whatever, but they weren't the issues of political change, which were central to bringing about political change. You know, that was the thing. I don't know whether that explains it, but it's essentially it was an organization that it was being superseded by other forces. And of course, the British British government would love that, you know.
The Widgery report was clearly a whitewash, but the Savile report was not much better.
Of course, given the amount of money they spent on it and the length of time that they took on it and all the rest of it, they were going to come up. You see, Widgery actually confined himself to an hour, the hour of the killing. He wouldn't hear any talk about the, you know, what were the factors that led to the march and all the rest of it. You know, he just, except where, of course, he would listen to evidence about how good the paras were and how, you know, they were, how it was totally out of character for them to do anything wrong on the stuff. But Savile was more nuanced, more subtle, and all the rest of it. But at the end of the day, he did the important job, which was, and he blamed people. You know, your man, that Wilford. See, Wilford is now living in Belgium, believing that he was totally wronged by the military and by the British government. He feels he is at a right. That was the para commander. And he was, of course, slated by Savile. But you couldn't, Savile couldn't have done anything else. The stuff there, the evidence was so glaring that he couldn't have done that. But he let Wilford's superior off. He, when challenged about some of his intervention, some of his the fact that he was there and all this sort of stuff and so on. He, your man, said, was it Jackson? Wasn't it Jackson was the head honcho? He said, oh no, I couldn't interfere with the chain of command. So that puts it back on the head honcho on the stuff. So, but it was quite clear that that the paras were doing what the army top brass in the north wanted. Now, Widgery or Savile doesn't say that. Savile lets him off the hook. So, in other words, Savile accepts your man's thing that, oh no, I couldn't interfere with the chain of command. Why was he at the barrier 14 for the entire period of that, the whole build-up to the thing, if it wasn't to interfere in the chain of command? He was there, certainly. And his direct superior in Belfast was in direct communication. Tuzo was in direct communication with the British political and civil service leadership in London. Now, Savile, you'd read Savile to your blue in the face. You never get any sort of clarity in relation to that. So it's a clever job. Widgery it was a rush job. It was a contemptuous job, actually, in that they thought, well, the paddy's sure the good value for it. And who better than to bring the Lord Chief Justice of England to tell them what a load of idiots they are. But Savile, I mean, you had all the years building up of that and the publicity, and all the rest of it. So they had to do a job. And Savile did a job. He did it, okay. But he didn't, as you say, he didn't clarify the issues.
50 years on, the families are still waiting for justice. With the proposed amnesty, is there any doubt that this will make things even harder for families to receive the truth and justice they deserve?
Yeah, well, I mean, if the Labour Party was any way, they would be campaigning against that in a serious way. I mean, I don't even know what their British Labour Party's official stance on it is. But you see, this is what I mean about, you see, for what passes for politics in the North is they look to Washington for, they think, whereas the basis of civil rights was that we have to build, that our natural allies are in Britain. You know, and that's not something that you just build up in 2 seconds or whatever. You have to build that up over the years. And it's, you know, you have certain principles, like, for example, you don't try to dictate British politics. You just look for solidarity with what we're doing here. Similarly, we don't let them interfere in what, that they say, well, you do this or you do that on the thing. But you work on the basis of mutual solidarity. But instead of that, they all rush off to Washington. It's get endorsement from. Now, that's the sort of an issue has Biden actually made any pronouncements on that amnesty thing there? Yeah, the statute of that. Even if he has, a Washington intervention is just it's a soundbite. It's not, you know, build campaigns on soundbites. But I it's funny, I was just talking to somebody this morning, and I have a very bad feeling about, with Biden in control in Washington, that a lot of very negative things are going to be coming from Washington on the North. I just have it might be old age and all the rest of it, and you sort of, you get less optimistic about the world, but I don't know what it is. I just feel that it's bad. And from what I see, I mean, the SDLP, I don't think have the clout that they had in Washington previously. The Provisionals have an organization there, but I think it's just fundraising and things like that. But I think in terms of what now passes for responsible politics, if Washington takes a line on something, the local, if northern people will take that as, you know, as thing. But on that issue, and as on all the other things, I think the important thing is that civil rights, our allies were in Britain. Our principal allies in Britain, nobody rejected. For example, I remember after Bloody Sunday, I had to go out to Washington to speak to a US Senate Foreign Affairs Committee on the way forward. And the assumption was that I would call for direct rule from London, the abolition of Stormont and direct rule. And my visa process and all was fast-tracked and all the rest of it. And I was got out there with all the rest of them. And it was only when, and that was, there were the SD, Austin Curry and the likes of those ones. And it was only when I got out there that somebody had the wit to say, well, what are you going to say? And I said, well, I'm going to call for a Bill of Rights. I'm going to oppose direct rule. And of course, this caused total consternation in the ranks. Now, I'm not saying that to think, because I then went on and I did say that, but they would have cancelled me if they could, but I was already advertised as being there. Now, what I just use that to illustrate the thing that whoever heard of that Senate, I mean, except ones that are follow these things in Washington, but those sort of almost semi-subterranean pressures that come from Washington and which are not benign. I mean, the direct rule thing was totally, and history showed it to be totally on. So that's why I always am afraid of that as a source of misdirection for the thing. Now, I don't know. I have a feeling, and this is maybe we're totally off our subject now, the whole militarization, EU militarization, and membership of NATO and all the rest of it. Well, I don't think we're going to be in NATO, maybe not before I'm buried 6 foot under. I mean, I can't see that immediately. But the militarization process, I think there's a lot of stuff going on there. So the quid pro quo is, if we are going to, Washington is going to say something about the relative of the Bloody Sunday thing, what are we going to get in return from you? You know, and that's the sort of thing. For example, if we want you to become more, up your military spending, do this, that, and the other thing, we'll say something. No. I know that doesn't sound as a rational answer.
No, but it makes, I agree. I mean, Washington aren't, they never do anything for nothing. So it's always kind of quid pro quo.
The whole phony thing about the Russians and the thing. I mean, that was all a stage thing. And I saw somewhere yesterday, some polls suggest there's an increase in support for Ireland joining NATO now. People are becoming more supportive of the idea. You can expect more of that sort of thing, you know. Somebody said, you know, you brainwash people and then you have a poll just to see how successful your brainwashing exercise is.
To finish up, I'd like to talk about the legacy of NICRA. I think it's important to remember that NICRA did achieve things which were revolutionary for their time and in the context of which they were achieved. It was through NICRA that the B Specials were disbanded and the RUC disarmed, the achievement of one man, one vote. But through the actions of the Provisionals and others, the RUC were rearmed and the B Specials were replaced by the UDR.
In hindsight, one of the possibilities of if NICRA had got off the ground in 65, that in fact they would have been able to deal better with the ultra left, because they would have, you know, they had the political experience and the trade unions and so on of, first of all, recognizing the stupidity of a lot of ultra-leftist positions, and more to the point of not conceding to them. You know, by and large, with hindsight, you should have said to the PDs, you know, okay, if you don't want to civil rights, you have Kevin Boyle, who's three, I think, on the, if you don't want that, you know where you can go. You know, go do your own thing. Because you see, they were riding on the backs of civil rights. They could never have got a mass march or a mass meeting or whatever on their own. So it was a convenient little thing for them to have civil rights as a flag of convenience. Now that's an elementary, I mean, your first day as in a workplace and the politics of the workplace, it'll always be, they'll always use, the ultra element will always use a flag of convenience to advance their own thing. Critical engagement, I think, is the word that they would use. You know, a lot of engagement when it's bringing them political kudos, and a lot of criticism when they're wanting to push their own line. The potential always, and the superiority always, of politics as a way of bringing about change. It was bad. I mean, an important initial ingredient in civil rights, as said, was politicizing republicanism. That was, you can't understand civil rights without understanding those two elements that went to make it up: politicizing republicanism and the Protestant trade unions, progressive Protestant trade unions. And the tragedy was that always along the line, you had 65. If it had got off the ground in 65, it would have been able to counteract a lot of the negative stuff that happened between that 65 and 67, when it actually did get off the ground. And then further on, the whole idea of a politics, it developed a political program that was key to any sort of democratic way and peaceful way forward. But again, it didn't get the opportunity to push for that, and to push for that in the most benign situation. It was, everything was going to be, you had the 69, you had the whole of sectarian violence, you had the ultra-leftism at the beginning of 69, you had then in coming up to 1970, you had the growth of the provisionals and all the rest of it, who had no conception of civil rights, for whom civil rights was British rights. Damn your concessions, England, we want our country. And they're still pushing for it. And in fact, it's damn your concessions, England, we're in with Brussels now. And they have our country. You know, and not recognizing, in fact, I don't know, this is a pet thing of mine, that if there is a national question in Ireland, which I believe there is, there are two elements to it. There's the partition element to it and all the consequences that came from that. The other element in it is the failure of the the part that got the maximum degree of freedom to be able to create a society and an economy and a politics of its own because of, as a consequence of that partition. And and those are the two elements to it. And of course, just talking about Irish unification and holding referendums and all that sort of, which of course are in the gift of the British government. There'll be no referendum on a united Ireland unless London says so, and unless London actually introduces the legislation. And you can talk about a united Ireland till you're blue in the face if you don't recognise that basic constitutional political power fact. You know, you're hoodwinking people.
Thank you for your time, Kevin. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. And thank you all for listening. We will be back again soon with another episode. So until then, slán go fóill.